accession number 20376, reel 3.
Peter Fisher, reel 3.
I just had to go to Remembrance Sunday, and my medals, which had been stuffed in the boxes in a drawer, never mounted, never worn, except my young son at one time found them. Oh, could he pin them on? Well, the Korean British service one didn't have a clasp, that had to be pinned on with a safety pin so he could play with them, army games with his friends. And then they got pushed back in the drawer, you know, for a long, long time. I got them out, sent them off to a firm, had them mounted so I could wear them. It was important that I went to this Remembrance Sunday wearing my medals for wearing my medals for Eric, which I did, very tearful. Down in the old Steen, but in Brighton. I felt pretty good once I'd done it. I've done something about this thing that had pushed to the back of my mind for more than 45 years. And I realised then that what I must do the next year was go to Remembrance Sunday in Scunthorpe, which was the home of Eric. And later I thought it would be nice to try and get in touch with Eric's family. I got in touch with a local newspaper in Scunthorpe, their Telegraph, and the reporter I spoke to, he said, well, I could write you something. I said, no, it has to be myself. And I know at that time of that first Remembrance Sunday, I'd also come to the conclusion only a week before, I must write something about this. And it was from Tuesday to the Sunday, I wrote, it was about 7 or 8 pages, a poem, a long one, all about about Eric and Korea and coming home. And Eric didn't come home. And it was so, to go to Scunthorpe and hope to contact his family was a big, a really big step. And I sat writing letters and screwing them up. It was difficult to put what I wanted to say in a letter. And then I thought, you idiot, write a poem. And it came so easily. 4 verses. Two verses, 1952 as it was then, 1992, or was it 5, as it was now, 96. That was it, 1996, as it was now. And it came so easily, and can I quote you a bit?
Please.
Of all the poems I've written, it's only this first verse, but it says it all. How could I knock at your front door? Stand on the step and my presence say, I am here, I came home from war, that is why I stayed away. I can't quote you anymore, but it said all that I wanted to say so simply, and which to my mind is what poetry is about, saying things with economy, saying just exactly what you want to say and nothing in excess. And I sent that off to Scunthorpe, and they printed it in its entirety. Didn't do anything. In fact, they gave it plenty of space. My own local paper here in Brighton would have cramped it into a tiny little corner, but no, this reporter. And he gave it a title. I never did. He called it Soldier's Sorrow. And that night, the phone just didn't stop ringing. People ringing up. They'd read it, so moved by it, they had to respond. I can't imagine them responding to an ordinary letter in the same way. But the thing is, one of the, what came from it is that his wife had died, and his son had died, and our second husband had died, his mother and father was dead. And it was only a week later that I found out the only survivor of the family was a cousin, Vera. But that night, there was another Eric rang up, and he says, I've got nothing to do with Eric's family, but I've got his medals. I asked him then, you've got his medals? How? Would you sell them to me? No, he says, I collect medals, I don't sell them. And he was a medal collector who liked, if he could buy medals that were named, as they are on the rim, he can trace, try and find out the history of the person. And in fact, the history was really, he wrote off to the Ministry of Defence and they got as far as he could. But seeing this poem, somebody wanted to know about Eric and he got his medals. And the story, I went to see him, and the story was that he'd found out that Eric's wife, the son, Wayne, Eric's son that is, was being killed in a motorbike accident when he was 18. His wife, Joyce, had been pestered by the family, ought to get married in. She did get married again, she had another son. Eventually that second husband died of cancer, and eventually she died of cancer also. And the son of the second marriage, clearing the house, there was these medals still in the box, untouched. You could see, this is actually, she'd received them, opened the boxes, saw what they were, and just closed the boxes and pushed them away in a drawer. They didn't mean anything. They were no replacement for Eric. And they turned up in a junk shop. You know, all the bits and pieces, you know, one of the way these junk shops are clear, family homes. And he knew that Eric, the shop owner, knew that Eric was interested. I've got some medals here, you might be. And anyway, there was Eric's, and I went up to see him, and I held Eric's medals in my hand. And he did say then, I've been thinking about it since, and I will sell them to you. You can have them. And meanwhile, I made a folder. That's this one. I'd made a folder putting all the things to do with Eric in it, with his photograph, with his medals. Well, that later on the medals came in. But he was so pleased to meet somebody that had been with Eric and could tell him the real history of Eric and those medals. I don't think he'd ever had such a complete history to one of his collections. But the nice thing is, I have Eric's medals, and you're not supposed to. Wearing your own is one thing, wearing somebody else's medals. But I must admit, I go on one or two parades now and I wear Eric's medals instead of mine. So wearing my own doesn't mean anything, but wearing Eric's medals means a lot to me. But it's that trauma, all started with that trauma and then pushing everything out. That, so as I learnt to call it later, an out-of-body experience. And I knew somehow that if I hadn't fought against it, I would have been dead. I'd have been found dead in my dugout from unknown causes. And the curious thing about it is that another bereavement in 1970 that left me in a very, very emotional state again. It was one I had to keep secret. It was an illicit girlfriend, one that Sheila didn't know about. She was a girlfriend that I knew. We didn't have an affair, but ever since I often wish we had. So in some respects it was quite, what's the word? It wasn't sexual.
It was platonic.
But it was a very sincere friendship. And this young woman had killed herself. I know she told me she was depressed, and I didn't know what depression was. And I knew afterwards. I had it for 4 damn years. And I knew if only I'd have known, I could have done something to save her. It would probably have meant a proper affair, but it would have saved her. But what? It was that, if I may, please. Because what happened, because there had to be an inquest, and her mother was involved in this, so the inquest was postponed. There was a period of no man's land, literally, in my mind. I went about my work, my job and everything, on automatic pilot. And when the day eventually did arrive for the funeral, which I attended, I know afterwards I said to my colleague, I was teaching at the College of Art here in Brighton then, and the principal was there with me, and when I went back I said, I can't face going into college, Dick. He said, well, are you teaching? I said, no, not this afternoon. Don't go then. So I went to walk along the cliff top, start to Rottingdean, and then back again. Eventually arrived home. Absolutely knackered is the best word for it. Went to bed, and I was in this place again, another out-of-body experience. I was there looking at my own dead body again, travelling in this place. And I met my father, and I met Eric. He was there. And there, where this light was, would be this young lady, Christine. And this time, though, I didn't mind being dead. I had my hand out. But she refused it. She sent me back. She said, your wife and your son need you. Go back. And I came back. A second experience out of body. When I could have finished up dead. In fact, wished to, but was sent back. But she did say that she'd come for me. When it was time, she would come for me. And I still have that belief now, that she'll come for me when it's time. And Eric will be there as well. It's a very comforting thing. But the odd thing is that from that date onwards in 1970, when it came to a time in 1990s, when 1992, when I was having counselling for some nightmares I've been having, which in fact all my problems with Eric and career came bubbling out. All my problems with Christine came bubbling out. What I thought had buried in my mind all came to the front. And not only did I not know in 1992 the day that Eric was killed, I didn't know the day that Christine, I knew the date she died, but I didn't know the day of the funeral, the day of the second out-of-body experience. And this is what my brain had done for me. It had completely covered the tracks of two very, very disturbing dates in my life. I later found out the date, which same as I found out the date eventually of Eric's death. And that was, I went up to the Shropshire Light Infantry Regimental Museum at Shrewsbury. Thought I might find something there, and I did. I found the tattiest, scruffiest untidy written roll of honour for those killed in the KSLI in Korea that you could ever wish to see. You couldn't see a scruffier one, untidier one. And on it were the names of Eric and Gordon Shields, but not Jimmy Smiley. His name wasn't on it. There was a James Smith. But if he was James Smiles, there was three different dates. And in fact, what I did get by writing off to the MOD later was a plaque showing the grave of Eric and Jimmy Smiles and Gordon Shields in Pusan, the white wooden crosses that we saw when we honoured our dead before we left Korea to come home in Pusan Cemetery. Rows and rows of pristine white crosses. Now there's nice low mounds with a very, very nice bronze plaque inscribed, name, regiment and the date. 28th of July. Not the 16th of July, 28th of July. So I was wrong. So I accepted 28th. Until I was writing a poem about this out-of-body experience in Korea. I was writing about, I'd written a poem, a long one, about 6 or 7 pages, about a good day in the trenches, what a good day was, what it consisted of for 24 hours. And I thought then, as I was getting to the end of that, if you can write about a good day, you can write about the worst day. So I did an horrific day in the trenches. And it was this out-of-body experience, this coming up to this out-of-body experience. And I'd written this, I got to the point of a first draft. Yeah, from all the scruffy notes, getting it into order, got into a first draft. I passed it to Sheila, my wife. What do you think of this? And Sheila said, I know you wrote and told me about this. And I said, I didn't. You did. I didn't. You did. I didn't. Typical. And then she crowned it. Well, I was only reading your letter a few days ago. This was complete. Reading what? Reading my letter. What you don't know, she said, is that I saved, she was my sweetheart at that time, I used to, was writing to her regularly. I saved all your letters, kept them in a shoebox at home. Then we eventually married, moved down to Plymouth, teach at the College of Art there, then moved to Brighton to teach at the College of Art here. And only later on, after her father died, and then our mother died, and of course, the house had to be cleared, and apparently she brought this shoebox full of letters back home here to here in Brighton under this roof. So I said, where? So she told me. So I went and had a look in these drawers at the side of her side of the bed, and there was this shoebox with letters, rummaged through. I couldn't find anything, not of that time, not for July the 16th, that's what I was looking at, and July, then I thought, well, it has to be then, July 28th. So look a bit beyond there, and looking into August, there was his letter, dated the 1st of August, telling her about Eric being killed, but didn't tell her anything about the experience, the nightmare experience in the dugout that night, which she had to admit afterwards. So this was the first time she'd ever heard about it. In fact, she was the first time I'd written about it. First time I'd told anybody about it. None of my family, no one. In fact, there's so many things that you don't talk about. I remember when we'd come home from Korea in October, early November. Later on, I on leave for Christmas. Typical radio program of that time, Forces' Favourite. More still, this was a Christmas Day Forces' Favourite, visiting all the theatres where, you know, around the world, where there was a long, long, several hours long, visiting places where there is British forces, and they visited Korea. And the family were sat Christmas dinner, Christmas Day, Christmas dinner, and they visited Korea. Up to that point, wherever they visited, no problem. But there they were, requests from Korea to the family, sweethearts and wives at home. And all of them were saying the same thing. Be home soon. And I knew that not everybody came home from Korea. Eric didn't. And I just burst into tears. Tears dribbling into my Christmas dinner. Just had to dash off into the kitchen to be on my own. I know my brother, he's 2 years older than me. I had an older one too at 10 years, but he was married and living with his own wife then. But he's always said he knew there was things in Korea that I never spoke about. And I still didn't speak about them even after that, but they knew, all the family knew that something there was. In fact, I've become to think that there's a part of me buried with Eric in that cemetery in Busan. Some corner of a foreign field. British dust concealed. I forget how the poem goes. It's a famous one. But there's a corner of a foreign field where there's Eric, my other two mates, and lots of other chaps as well, lying buried, enriching the soil of Korea, really, with their blood. It's part of me there. I sometimes feel, when I'm cremated, I'd like some of my ashes to go there, to be scattered there, to complete the journey. But that's my worst day. It's nothing to do with battle, being shot at, shelled or whatever, being wounded, being injured. And it's tied up with so many other aspects throughout my life that's become entangled, intermingled with it.
Did you ever get wounded in Korea?
No. So many near misses. Oh, you don't count near misses. Do you drive?
Yes.
Do you count the near misses? When almost by a hair's breadth, you know, something you missed and have an approaching car or something that catches you really by surprise. There's lots of near misses. But there's lots of near misses there. Say the time when in the morning I developed, we used to bath. The water came up. We used to collect water in the old jerry cans, the 4 gallon jerry cans. And also the empty cases from the £20 Centurion tank shell cases. Gather our water in that. Water for drinking, making tea. Lovely way of making tea. Well, back to the desert days, the Eighth Army lads. So we didn't have sand in our petrol, we just had petrol. Can of petrol, couple of bars across, can of water on top. Stand well back, throw a lighter match at the petrol and whoosh. In seconds, your water's boiling, a handful of tea in, lift it off, tin of carnation milk. It was nectar. In those days, that was nectar, ambrosia. I can taste it. You know, only have to think about it and you can taste it. And it would be revolting now to me to drink it, but I think I'll probably drink it for old time's sake. But being boiled over petrol, it added, there's special flavours to it.
Did you ever fall sick in Korea?
No. No, apart from, I say, one morning I was having to go back to the RA, regimental aid post. And despite bathing, and bathing was from collecting the water, we had, you know, the half a biscuit tin, about 4 or 5 inches high, not square. You can stand with one foot in it diagonally, and you'd bathe from head down to that foot, and then you'd swap feet so you could do that leg as well. That was the bathing. But despite that, I developed sweat rash under the arms, around the groin and ankles. It used to be torment like hell at night time. It was an itch that was a burning itch that was painful. The only way to relieve it was to rub it. But if you did, it came back worse, so you learnt not to. And I was having to go back early in the morning to the RAP just simply to get some, I think it was permanganate potash daubed all over it. It used to sting like hell, but it was preferable to... It got rid of it. But okay, despite that, we took every chance we could to keep clean. But okay, you got things like sweat rashes because of this terrific heat during the summer days and the humidity at night. Mind you, I count myself fortunate that I was there in the summertime and we came home with the battalion and didn't have to spend a winter there, because the winters, in fact, I've been doing some work just now in memoriam. In fact, 4 days ago, it was the 50th anniversary of the start of the Korean War, June 25th. And I'm now editor of our local Korean Veterans Association. And what I set out to do 18 months ago is bearing fruit. And with each quarter, I'm publishing the names, but not like in a book of remembrance where there's just the rank and the name and the unit. Name, the initials come in nicely before the name, their age, and the number of 19, 20, 21 year olds killed there in Korea before they've even started a real mature life. That hurts. The day they died and the unit. I'm trying to find out more details now, but that's going as an ongoing thing through the next 3 years. And it's, these ages was hurting a lot, but it's doing this sort of thing that I've lost my thread a bit. Where was I?
Could I ask you another question about the enemy? What did you think of the enemy in Korea?
Apart from clashing with them at night, you don't see them. Unless you're in action, and this is a real attack, defensive action, that would typically might start with the Chinese at night time, that would run through the next day, and probably run into several days, as at the Battle of the Imjin. But okay, seeing them, we was in a quiet corner of the Commonwealth Division line, down at the Samichon, on the Samichon, on Yongdong. And apart from patrolling, that was on the shelling, okay, there's contact with shells, but apart from patrolling and bumping Chinese patrols in the pitch black, all you ever saw of Chinese was what they saw of you, the red flames from the muzzle of the weapons and the flash of grenades.
But did you have any chance to wreak revenge on them?
Sorry?
Did you have a chance to take revenge on them?
At the time, I think I did. I can look back now and hope I didn't. It's not the emotion of revenge. It's not a pretty one. It's not one I can look on back on and be proud of. To think that you're worse than an animal, you're going out deliberately to kill if you can. Not kill because you need food, like a fox will kill, or other animals kill, an owl will kill mice and things and straight away eat them. No, killing just for the sheer lust of it, it's nothing to be proud about. There's no pride there. This is another change, I think, in all those years, from the revenge to being something not to be proud of.